4. I guess we don't really need this. Glenn, we love having Glenn here, but I'm a little angry at him this time. Because he brought very bad news. And that is, this program that I use all the time, BibleWorks, I use it all the time. I love this Bible study software. And he brought me the sad news that they are ceasing to make it. And they said they're going to maintain BibleWorks version 10 for a little while. But then that's it. No more. I'm on my own. So I'm kind of, yeah, that's sad. I love this program. But at any rate, it should work for years to come if Microsoft will stop destroying itself with updates. My computer, I wish I could shut off updates so bad. I wish I could. Because my computer went and ran itself an update. And even with the old versions of Microsoft Windows, you could tell it when or whether you wanted it to update. And if you wanted it to update, you could tell it when to update. This version doesn't even ask you. It just shuts down. And then for the next half an hour, you're sitting there saying, I was going to do something. Now I can't because this dumb thing's installing updates. And it's just a stupid little spinny circle going around and around and around. And please wait. Do not shut off your computer. We are installing updates. 1%. Please wait. Do not shut off your computer. We are installing updates. 1%. Go ahead. Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. Well, the only way to control it is don't shut the computer off, because it'll pop up this little dialogue that says, can we restart your computer now or do you want to wait an hour? And I always click on wait an hour, but if that pops up and you're not there to say wait an hour, it'll shut it down and start installing. So as long as Windows doesn't change itself too much, I'll be able to continue to use BibleWorks. So. Well, I wanted to bring up the map for you here so we can get an idea of where everything is going on. We've been covering some of the miracles that Elisha is performing. And they are all miracles towards individuals, displaying God's abundant care of the individual as much as he cares about nations. And so, wrong button. Most of Elisha's stuff is centering here in the northern kingdom of Israel. Samaria, right here, is the capital of the northern kingdom. The last miracle that we saw revolved around a woman from this town called Shunem. So she's the Shunemite. But today we're going to see a couple other miracles as we finish up chapter 4. There's two short accounts of two more miracles that happen that we're going to cover before we get it back into Naaman's leprosy. I didn't finish this last week, so we'll go ahead and finish it. So verse 38 of 2 Kings chapter 4. 2 Kings 4, 38. Elisha came again to Gilgal when there was a famine in the land. So Gilgal, there are two Gilgals. There's one down here in the Jordan River Valley. And there's another one up here in the hills of Ephraim. So which one we're talking about is probably this one up here. We saw this with his little circuit that he made after Elijah was taken to heaven in the chariots. Elisha made a trek back through the towns, and the path went from Jericho to Bethel, and then it mentions Gilgal. So he probably didn't go up the mountains and then come back down. He went to this one here in the middle. So he goes to Gilgal when there was a famine in the land. And as the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, set on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. So we said the sons of the prophets is this group of men and their families who would gather together. They would train probably in studies of the Old Testament that they had. Of course, what were the books that they had? They had the first five books, right? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It's all they had at this point. Well, no, I'm sorry. They probably had Joshua, maybe Judges, depending on who wrote that one for us. But probably not Ruth. It seems like, you know, when we started this study into Samuel and Kings, it seems like Ruth, Samuel, and Kings, all written by the same person. So they probably had Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua to study from. But that was sufficient for them at the time because those books described the covenant by which the people were allowed to inhabit the land. And so God's agreement with them was, you know, look, when we rent property today, we sign a lease. You sign a lease, and that lease is an agreement between you and the owner of the property, what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do, whether you can paint the rooms or not paint the rooms, whether you can put nails in to hang pictures or not. You know, who covers repair costs? When I was in seminary, we had a landlord that owned the house, and the furnace broke down. And I had to argue with him round and round and round for a couple of hours that maintenance was his responsibility according to the lease. And he said, no, heating and cooling is you. I said, yeah, I pay for the gas, I pay for the electric, you pay for repairs on the furnace. And he said, no, you pay for the heating and cooling. It's the furnace, so that's you. I said, no. So we went round and round with this stuff. The guy was a lot of fun. Kim rolls her eyes. He was not a lot of fun. So, all right, how did they get there? That train is about 5 spurs away from the main line. Sign the lease, thank you. Okay, so we sign the lease. That lease is an agreement between the two parties. You get to stay in my house, here's what you can and can't do, here's what you're responsible for. The old covenant is like a lease between God who owns the land and the people and what they're supposed to do to live in the land. Okay, the old covenant, Paul tells us this in the New Testament, was never meant as a way of salvation. He makes very, very clear that the old covenant was never meant as a way to earn forgiveness of sins before God. That has always been by believing God's word, never by earning it. Okay, even that's why he points back. We talked about this a little bit this morning when he points back to Abraham and says Abraham believed God's promise regarding an heir, and therefore it was credited to him as righteousness. When did that happen? Before or after Abraham received the covenant sign of circumcision? It was way before. So salvation's always been by believing God, never by earning forgiveness of sins. Jesus earned our forgiveness when he died on the cross. He bore our sins. We receive that simply by believing it, not by earning it. So the faithful people in the Old Testament recognized that they could never earn the forgiveness of their sins by doing the works of the law. David says, how blessed is the man to whom transgression will not be imputed, right? Or how blessed is the man whose sins are forgiven, to whom the Lord will not impute transgression. That's David recognizing this. Look, I bring in those animals as sacrifices, that doesn't forgive my sin. God just has to forgive it. And on some basis, they couldn't quite pinpoint how God was going to accomplish forgiveness, but they knew that he would do it somehow through a Redeemer. And so that eventually we know is Jesus. So they're dwelling in the land. I'm getting a little off topic there again. But they're dwelling in the land under the terms of the covenant. And when they refuse to obey the covenant, God keeps warning them through the prophets, if you keep violating the terms of my covenant, I will kick you out. Just like a landlord would do. You keep smoking in here and you're not supposed to smoke, I'm going to sign the eviction notice. That's what the trip to Assyria and to Babylon was. You're not keeping my covenant, get out of my land. Okay. Well, the sons of the prophets were trying to call the northern nation of Israel back to faithfulness to the covenant. Say, look, guys, we're worshiping these two golden calves. God told us not to do that when he said, you shall not make unto yourselves any graven images. We're treating people unfairly in the way that we pay them or enslaving them. God said, don't do that. In all these ways, the sons of the prophets were functioning very much like pastors and evangelists function today. Sometimes those prophets were giving direct revelation from God. Most of the time they were explaining the revelation the people already had in the written word, in those 5 books of Moses, okay? And so here's Elisha. He's taken Elijah's place as the leader of the sons of the prophets. So he gets to Gilgal. There's a famine in the land. God is probably using this famine to try to call the people back to him again. Apparently, we're not going to have a famine quite yet. It's going to take a little while to dry out that water we got in the last few days, right? But we've had dry years, but we've never had anything like what they experienced, probably not since the Dust Bowl day. When was the last time we had a really severe drought that lasted more than a year? Eldon, do you remember?
2012, in the area where my farm is at. My brother combined whole fields and had an empty hole.
Really? Yeah. We were in Sutter that year, and it was really dry, but they did okay. So you're farther south than Sutter, right?
But it's
just the narrow strip had it? Okay. Well, there's a famine going on here, so what are they going to eat? When Elisha says, all right, put on a big pot of stew for everybody. So anybody ever eaten in a college cafeteria or in a big group? All right. We always used to tease the cooks at school. We had great cooks. Susie was fantastic. It was kind of fun, though, because whatever didn't get eaten one night came the next day with cheese on it. Okay? And it was always fun because, you know, we'd have spaghetti one night. The next night we'd have spaghetti with cheese all over the top. And that's how she would reuse some things. But you know how hard it is to cook for massive amounts of people. We get that like every day in our house. How do you cook for 8-9 people here? Nothing we do is small. We like to do everything big, right? So, and you would think we could keep up with the egg supply, but then chickens are laying eggs faster than we can eat them. So if anybody wants some eggs, let us know. What do we have, 6 dozen over there now? So if you're interested in some farm fresh eggs, we have some you can have. Okay. All right, what are you going to put on? There's a famine in the land, so he orders this big pot of stew, and verse 38, one of them went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it his lap full of wild gourds. And he came and cut them up into the pot of stew, not knowing what they were. So how good of an idea is it, Gary, to just go out into the woods and find plants and cut them up, throw them into a pot and eat them? You might end up with a poison stew, yeah. Now, if you're good at identifying plants, you might be able to say, oh, yeah, that's lamb's quarter. It ain't tasty, but it'll work, right? And Gary would say, I think I'd rather starve than eat lamb's quarter stew. I don't know. If they have any butter and salt, it might go down kind of nice, right? So he finds these gourds. You're in the middle of a famine. Things are tight. Food is scarce, so you do what you got to do. He brings these gourds back, he chops them up, throws them into the stew. Well, what Gary said happened is what happens. Verse 40, they poured out some for the men to eat. But while they were eating the stew, they cried out, oh, man of God, there is death in the pot. Not, fellas, by the way, not something you want to tell your wives when she sets dinner in front of you, right? there's death in the pot. Kim teases me because one time in our married life, one time, she made instant mashed potatoes and I actually choked on them. Just a little bit. But she's never let me live that down. And that was 10 years ago. What's that? A little more than that, yeah. So anyway, they cry out, there's death in the pot. Just by tasting it, they realize, oh, those gourds were a bad idea. Something wrong with them, or it's a plant that you couldn't eat. And they realize, we're going to die if we try to eat this stuff. So what's the answer for it? They could not eat it. So verse 41, he said to them, then bring flour. And he threw it into the pot and said, pour some out for the men that they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot. Okay. We are not saying that flour is an instantaneous cure to all poisons. Okay, if you swallow poison, call the poison control centers and let them know what to do. Okay, Dan will help you too. Do you deal with poison sometimes? Not very often. Okay, it's not the flour that he throws in here. You say, well, then why does he command to throw flour in? The same reason he commanded to throw a stick into the bitter water. Remember that miracle that happened? The water was bitter, and he says, throw a stick in there. And he throws the stick in, and the water's good. It's not the stick. It's not the flour. It's the working of God. And so he throws the flour in. They do what they're supposed to do. But the picture here is that does God care about his people? Yes. Here's a famine going on. Here are these faithful men trying to minister to the nation of Israel by preaching his word, and they're all threatened either with starvation or with poisoning. But is God going to look after this and take care of it? Yes, because they trust him. You notice who they go to when they find the problem? Who do they cry out for? Oh, man of God. Yeah, they cry out to the prophet, the leader, the guy through whom God is obviously working at the time. And so they recognize if anyone's going to save us, it's going to be him. Okay. So, does God care about his people? Yes. Now, next one. Starting in verse 42, a man came from Baal Shalishah. How would you like to live in that town? Sounds like fun, doesn't it? Baal Shalishah. Bringing the man of God bread of the first fruits, 20 loaves of barley, and fresh ears of grain in his sack. Where was the first fruit harvest supposed to go? According to the law. To God, but God doesn't eat, right? So where did he command that it go? To the tabernacle or the temple for the priests to use. Who is he bringing it to? Elisha. Is Elisha a priest? No. Why doesn't he take it to the temple? You're going to have to think through your 10th century BC political situation here. There was a temple. David built a temple in Jerusalem. But what country are we living in? Yeah, Jerusalem is in the southern kingdom. Remember, after Solomon, his son Rehoboam raised the taxes so high that the kingdom split into two. There's a northern kingdom of Israel. There's a southern kingdom of Judah. The temple is in the southern kingdom of Judah. And Judah and Israel are not getting along real, real well. So this guy can't really travel down south to Jerusalem to give the offering of the first fruits there. So he does the next best thing he can think of, which is give it to the school of the prophets. So he brings this donation, the first fruits, and the donation consists of 20 loaves of barley bread and a sack of grain. The harvest has not been very good, if that's what he's bringing. That's not much, because we're not talking about huge loaves of bread. We're talking about, you know, little loaves of bread. And your family ever raise barley? Barley's sort of the lower class wheat. You can raise wheat. You live on wheat. Wheat is extremely good for you. Barley is kind of, it doesn't taste as good, and it's not quite as nutritious. So the fact that it's barley bread tells you the famine is not going well, and there's not a whole lot of produce. But this man faithfully brings it. Heard the song, Little as Much When God Is In It? Isn't that a great song? Because it reflects a truth that we understand. This miracle is going to reflect something actually that Jesus is going to do later on. Because look at what happens. He brings this small offering, and Elisha says, give to the men so that they may eat. But his servant said, how can I set this before 100 men? All right, so let's take a little loaf of bread, yay big, and let's cut it up. We have how many loaves? We got 20. All right, if there's 20 loaves, everybody gets how much of a loaf? About a fifth of a loaf. So we take something this long, and we cut it up into fifths, and you're getting a slice of bread, yay big. Okay, it's better than nothing, right? That's good. It's better than nothing. But the guy recognizes this is barely even a meal for these men. How can I set this before 100 men? So he repeated, give it to the men so that they may eat. For thus says the Lord. And here's the promise that comes. They shall eat and have some left over. Now, apparently there were no teenage boys in the house. Right? Okay. Because you don't set food out and have leftovers when you have teenage boys in the house. They eat. I don't know, maybe you wouldn't do that with barley bread. Maybe you'd let it go. It depends. If we put some of Abby's homemade jam on it, maybe it would go farther, okay? Abby's making strawberry jam because the strawberries are coming in. So they do it. They believe what God says through the prophet, and they do it. Verse 44, he set it before them, they ate, and they had some left according to the word of the Lord. Does God care about his people? Does God supply the needs of his people? Absolutely. When they trust him, he supplies. Is it always exactly what they want? No, because you know how many times have we all asked God to do something and he does something and we say, well, that's not really what I was thinking. But we almost always if we're learning, we learn later, oh, that was better. That was way better than what I was thinking. Because God is good, and God knows what his people really need, and he knows how to supply it. That message, the goodness of God, exercised towards those who trust him, in these miracles that we've looked at, has gone out to the average Tom, Dick, and Harry in Israel through Elisha and through the sons of the prophets. In chapter 5, however, we get to another guy who has nothing to do with Israel. But he's going to hear about the power of God, and he's going to act on it. It's a great story, the story of Naaman. How many of you read the story of Naaman before? Okay. A couple of you, all right. So the rest of you that haven't read this, you don't know what's going to come. Ooh, this is fun. Suspense. Okay, we'll try to make it as exciting as we can. So, chapter 5, verse 1, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of which country? Syria. Not cereal. Syria. Let me zoom out. All right. Whoop. Whoop. What'd I do? I zoomed in. Okay. Oh, because I got the zoom tool on. Yeah. Okay, this is Israel down here. This massive names is all the towns of Israel. So this is Israel. Northern Israel here. Southern Israel down here. Northern Israel, Samaria. Nah, not Samaria. I'm going to confuse you all. What name am I thinking of? Syria. Thank you. Syria. Syria is up here. Damascus is right in this mountainous region this way. So this is Syria. Once again, don't confuse Syria with Assyria. Different country. Assyria is over here. In the, they call it the Fertile Crescent, between the rivers of the Euphrates and the Damascus over this way. Assyria, in the period of time that we're looking at in these accounts, Assyria is sort of lingering in the background, but they are growing. Their power is getting much, much stronger, and they are going to play a role in what happens to Israel very, very soon. But they are not to be confused with Syria. There's Syria here and Assyria over this way. Okay? Thinking back to the lessons we've had before in these historical books, how do Israel and Syria get along? Not very good, Hannah says. Check mark on your English. Not very well, right? They don't get along very good. Just a few years before this happens, Syria invaded Israel, and Elijah, God used Elijah to stop them. They boasted and said, hey, it's because God is a God of the mountains, not a God of the valleys. Therefore, if we attack them in the valleys, we'll beat him. And God said, you know what? Just because they said that, I'm not going to let them win this battle so that they'll learn who I really am. And so Israel defeated Syria. That led to a 3-year peace treaty between Israel and Syria. Didn't last very long, though, because at the end of that 3 years, the king of Israel, whose name was Ahab, said, hey, let's go attack Syria. We're going to attack them here in Ramoth Gilead. At that time, Syria inhabited all this land up here and a big chunk of the western portion of Israel. They had captured it. So Ahab, the king of Israel, says to his friend Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, let's go attack the Syrians at Ramoth Gilead. How did that battle go? Not good. Not good. Ahab died. Jehoshaphat was driven back to Jerusalem in shame. And Ahab was killed. So Ahab's son, Ahaziah, takes the throne, and he only rules for 2 years, but then he dies because he fell off the upper story of his house and was injured. After Ahaziah dies, Ahaziah's brother, Joram, takes over Israel. So now we have Joram as the king, And he's still not getting along with Syria, the country to the north. They're having a lot of issues. So this fella, Naaman, is commander of the army of the king of Syria, one of Israel's most bitter enemies. But notice what has happened. He was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. So, isn't this an interesting little turn of events? One of the reasons that Syria is so powerful is because God has been using Naaman to give them victory. You say, why would God be raising up the power of Israel's enemy? Why would God allow Israel's enemies to be flourishing and gaining in strength? It's going to be a glorious battle when he defeats them, isn't it? Yes. Okay. Why did God allow the nation of Israel to get trapped in Egypt and enslaved for a couple hundred years? So that he could show his mighty power when he led them out? So that he could show Israel just how strong he is? History's a story. God is unfolding a story about himself in the events of history. Anybody ever heard that it's called history because it's his story? Yeah. God is unfolding a revelation about himself in history. And it all, as we talked about this morning, it all culminates in the person of Jesus Christ. So we're learning about God as history goes on. Now, one of the great things about the Old Testament scriptures is that we get God's commentary on history. If you study history from the time of Jesus to the time of now, you don't get that. You know, I love studying church history. You guys know that. I'm a nerd that way. But you know what you don't get when you study church history? God's commentary. You got to work through it and say, well, what did he do? Was that good? Was that bad? This leader of the church, he did this. That was good, but that was bad. And you got to try to sort through all that. God gives us his commentary on what's happening in these historical books, and so he doesn't leave us guessing. He gives us that information, and it's great. So God's working through Naaman to raise Syria to power through Naaman, but he was a mighty man of valor, but he's got a problem. And what's that problem? He's a leper. Not a leopard. A leper. Okay. Leprosy is a skin disease. It actually, the biblical term covers several different types of skin disease, but it was nasty and almost always fatal. But it took a long time to kill you. So here's Naaman. His arm is leprous, but he's still the commander of the army. If he were in Israel, what would have happened to him? He would have been ousted, right? Under the Old Covenant, people with leprosy were put on the outside of the community to keep that disease from spreading. It's highly, highly contagious. But in Syria, they don't follow God's laws. And so here's this leprous guy who is the commander of the armies. Well, that's a problem because that lets him know, hey, at some point, either I'm going to die in battle or this disease is going to kill me. He's a leper. Verse 2, another piece of the background information. Now, the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. We've read about these raids, okay? Syria often came down and attacked Israel, and in ancient warfare, when you attacked a town, you took everybody off as spoils of war. All the stuff and all the people, and they became servants. So here's this little girl, we don't know how old. This little girl gets captured by the Syrians and hauled back to Damascus, where she is put in the employ of Naaman. And she helps his wife with chores around the house. See, in those days, they didn't have dishwashers and vacuum cleaners, so guess how you got work done? You had help. Okay? Had somebody explain one time, when you read Proverbs 31, it talks about the virtuous woman, and you say, how does she get all this stuff done in a day? Well, because she didn't have washing machines, and she didn't have... She didn't have blenders. She had servants to help her. And that's one of the things it talks about, is she's making sure her servants are doing their jobs. So washing machine, dryer. Ladies, I know you guys are great multitaskers. And when that stuff's going all around in the house, you're managing it. Okay, that's a Proverbs 31 woman. where was I going? Okay, so this little girl is in the house of Naaman helping out with these daily chores. But her master has leprosy. Verse 3, she says to her mistress, I would that my Lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy. What does that tell you about how this little girl feels about her master? She cares about him. Okay? The slavery, the servitude that went on in the Old Testament wasn't always bad. Sometimes it was. But it wasn't always. So she is apparently being very well cared for because she has a great concern for her master. And she says, oh, I wish he could get to the prophet in Samaria. Who's the prophet in Samaria? Elisha. What does this little girl know that Elisha can do? Well, not necessarily Elisha, but God works through Elisha, doesn't he? Okay, we just read all these miracles. He gave the widow, or he gave the woman of Shunem a son. He multiplied the widow's oil. He raised that son back to life when he died of a heat stroke. He multiplied those loaves. In a little while, we're going to find him make an axe head float on water, an iron axe head. You ever seen that, Don Eldon? I knew you'd have a fun comment. There's got to be some kind of calculation you can run through based on the buoyancy of styrofoam, how to make an axe head float. I saw one time, what was that show? Mythbusters on History Channel. You guys heard of this show, Mythbusters? So they did one time, they wanted to bust the myth that you could fill a balloon with helium and float a lawn chair up into the air. Because they said they had heard about this on the internet or something. So they said, we're gonna try to bust that myth. And they did. They experimented a couple of times with filling balloons, and they couldn't get the chair to lift off the ground. And so they ran some calculations, and I think they figured out you'd have to have a balloon like the size of New York City, a helium balloon, to generate that much lift to lift off a chair. I wasn't that big. I'm exaggerating, but it was a huge amount of helium. So you ever wonder why those tanks of helium don't just lift right off the ground? I mean, if helium rises and you got all that helium in that tank, why doesn't it lift off the ground? Yeah, Bugs Bunny. All right. So this little girl expresses this concern, and she expresses an answer to the problem. And here this little girl is, in a very condensed way, telling Naaman how he can be saved from his leprosy. So who does God use to spread the glory of himself around the world? Everybody, right? Whoever will open their mouths and speak about him. Okay. So this little girl knows that there's a God in Israel, and he's working through Elisha. Verse 4, so Naaman went in and told his Lord, thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel. Now, he probably didn't actually say thus and so. That's to summarize. Okay. He goes to his master, the king of Syria, and says, this servant girl from Israel told me there is a holy man in Israel that can heal my leprosy. And the king of Syria said, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. Now, you see any problems arising out of this? How are Israel and Syria getting along right now? It's not great. It's kind of like the U.S. and North Korea right now. There might not be open war, but things are tense. And so the king of Syria says, yeah, I'm going to send the commander of my army down to Israel with a letter. This is a bold move for Syria, by the way. So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver. Oh, 10 talents of silver and 6,000 shekels of gold and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, when this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy. Now, how would you react if that letter came in to you? Huh? Laugh. You would laugh. All right? Okay. What does this letter communicate? Who does the king of Syria credit with the ability to do this? Why would he credit the king of Israel with the power to heal Naaman? They often did believe that kings were the sons of God, yes. But especially, okay, we value our First Amendment rights, right? I am allowed to think and believe however I want, and the government can't tell me otherwise, even if they think I'm dead wrong. Isn't that a great freedom? For good or bad, it's a great freedom. It didn't exist. The leader of the nation was almost always also the leader of the religious group. And so, when the king of Syria sends Naaman to Israel, he is assuming, because this is the way his nation operates, that the king of Israel has a very good control over the religion of his nation. And that any prophet, not money prophet, but any prophet, man of God prophet, is serving in the palace at the king's behest. That's why he sends him to the king. So he assumes that this prophet in Samaria, Elisha, must be a registered prophet, licensed, fully licensed by the government. Okay, because kings didn't let people practice religion apart from the state religion. Almost never happened. Well, he doesn't count on what's going on in Israel, because what's the state religion of Israel at the time? They're worshiping the golden calves, right. Ahab brought Baal worship in. Baal was the storm god of the Canaanites. So Ahab brought Baal worship in, but his son Joram sort of put the Baal worship back out and clung to the golden calf worship. So that's the official religion of the northern kingdom of Israel. But that's not the right religion. It's not the biblical religion. It's not what God had shown to the people of Israel. So the king of Syria thinks that the king of Israel must have this prophet in his employ and probably on the public roll, but he doesn't understand what's going on. So the king of Israel responds the way we would probably respond. Am I God to kill and make alive that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he's seeking a quarrel with me. So the king of Israel thinks, wait a second. That low down dirty snake, the king of Syria, he's trying to start a war. And when I say I can't heal the guy's leprosy and I send him on his way packing, they're going to come down with their armies and they're going to attack us. And they're going to say, ha, I tried to make peace with you and send you my commander and you refused him. So that's what King Joram thinks is going on here. I think maybe we'll pause there. We got a lot to cover here in the last part of the chapter. So that sets us up, gives us a good introduction. Any questions on what's going on here?